Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're just going to jump right into this interview. We have an amazing musician, trombonist, singer-songwriter, horn arranger. Am I missing anything, Mariel? Superhero. Female superhero. Let's add that in there. Mariel Austin, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, Nikki?
I'm good. Our studio audience loves you already. Look at that. Oh, yeah. So let's just jump right into it. You grew up in San Francisco?
Yeah.
You grew up in the Bay Area?
Uh-huh.
What city?
Berkeley, California.
Oh, right. That's like hippie central.
Pretty much. Yes.
And how did you get into music? I saw that you picked up trombone at 13, but you were singing in a girls' chorus.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and also my dad, he also sings and plays guitar, and he's always been singing and playing guitar, and he would sing to us, me and my sisters.
That's awesome. So you grew up in a musical family.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff would he play you?
Oh, just a lot of country, a lot of rock, a lot of songs that he sang. You know how a lot of lyrics say, like, oh, a little girl, oh, honey, oh, baby. He would sing
from that
to
generation.
Us. Yeah. Little girl. I always thought he was referring to me, you know, because at the time I was like only like 4 or 5 years old.
So yeah,
I thought
he was singing right to me.
Like, oh, I'm a little girl. I'm 4 or 5 years
You're
old.
Like, that's me. That's me.
Yeah.
And then you started, when did you get into the girls' chorus?
I was about 8 years old.
Was that through school or church or what?
Well, my older sisters were doing it, and so it was something that I had wanted to be a part of, you know, with them.
What kind of stuff were you singing?
Oh, a lot of things. Classical, Gregorian, spanning through all sorts of different ages throughout history, all sorts of different languages, you know.
We have a parallel, because I joined a children's chorus, too, so... I was doing a lot of the same kind of stuff. So I love, you know, those kind of moments, like singing with kids.
Yeah.
It's like the best, like with your other, you know, peers. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's something magical about like being that young and just kind of like focusing, you know, because like as a kid, you're all over the place. Your energy is all over the place. So to like have, you know, whether it's 10 or 30 or 40, however many kids are in it, all focusing to like make something beautiful and you know exact or whatever it is, it's like it shapes that teamwork thing, you know what I mean?
Oh yes, yeah, definitely builds camaraderie. You know, like a lot of people who I was in chorus with as like a little 6 year old I'm still friends with now.
That's awesome.
As a 30 year old
I'm the same. And the funny thing is, it's like you don't realize like how kind of magical those friendships are because of that, because of the music. And, you know, the other thing too, it's like, even if people don't pursue music after that, their ear is at least more in tune than the average person that loves music. That's what I love about, you know, just choruses in general that young. It's killing me that some of those are taken out of schools or there's no programs for that because of
that. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I could go on all night about how unfair and how you know, I think it's just so ludicrous that, like, a lot of programs are taken out of schools that pertain to the arts. You know, a lot of it, you get these kids who, who have a hidden talent, but they can't discover it because, you know, the arts are taken away, and they're forced to go to take the SATs and
that's not meant for everyone. That's the weird thing. It's like most people think, like, oh yeah, if we take this test, then they'll get into college. But that's not like the path that everybody, you know, wants to take necessarily, or how their brain works. You know what I mean? It's like, I didn't realize that I loved music in the way that I did until I was in college, you know? Mm-hmm. So you go through school, you're 13 years old. What made you pick up the trombone? That's an odd instrument for somebody to pick up at 13.
Charles Mingus, hearing the music of Charles Mingus, kind of drew it to me. I was seeing a concert of I was about 12 years old. I was in middle school at the time. I was about like sixth, seventh grade. And my family and I saw this concert that the high school jazz band was playing, and they played a song of Fables of Phoebus by Charles Mingus. And the big band arrangement of Fables of Phoebus has this big old like trombone line in the front, bass trombone line at the front. And when the instrumentalist played that line, I was like, whoa.
Like, what is that?
Yes, yeah, exactly. You had me right there. I was thinking, whoa, what is that? And, oh, I want that. I want to play that.
And you know what? So cool. Trombone looks cool to play, too. You know what I mean? It's, like, so ambiguous. I always, like, whenever I see a trombonist play, I'm like, dude, when you're sliding on notes, I'm like, how do you even know the positions? And, like, it's weird because, like, little movements make big differences, and sometimes big movements don't make huge steps. It's like crazy. So tell me about the instrument, because I don't know enough about. I love trombone. I've always loved trombone. I don't know enough about like how the trombone is built. So tell us a little bit about how it's kind of made up, how it's designed.
The anatomy of the trombone.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's so interesting to me.
Oh well, I mean, the trombone is basically just a metal tube. About 9 feet long, that's been bent. It's basically, take when you look at a paperclip, like just a regular old paperclip in the office, it's pretty much that. It's just like curved around, and you have one end that's, you know, narrow, which is like, you know, the mouthpiece end, and then it curves around, and it has, you know, the
horn.
Bell.
Yeah, the bell. That's
yeah,
right. That's
yeah,
right.
That's like the amplifier. And the slide has 7 positions, and each of those positions has a certain number of partials, so to speak. And those partials are pretty much like you can get a bunch of different notes per position. So if you have 7 positions, you've got like, I don't have a trombone with me right now, but
that's all right.
So I can't like, you know, illustrate it. But you have a certain number of partials per position.
You say partials, it's like accidentals, like sharps, flats, like that?
A little bit. By partials, I mean like when you're in one position, you can say, and this is not the scale, do, do, so, do. You've got those intervals. It's almost like intervals.
So you have intervals in the same position. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's different intervals in each position of the trombone.
So is it also based on like how the air is directed into the mouthpiece, or no?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like depending on how you direct the air, yeah, exactly. Like your aperture affects how the air is directed into the mouthpiece, and that affects like basically when you buzz air through the mouthpiece. You can either get do, so, do, and like, depending on your aperture. And that's just in the first position. In the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth position, you can get all these.
And do the intervals ever change? I've never, you know what's so funny? I've never asked a trombonist how this works. This is like so fascinating to me.
Do they change?
Yeah, like, so, like, you have 7 positions. if you go to the second position, is it still in fifths? Oh, it's all in fifths.
Or it's in like fifth and then fourth and then like F, B flat, D, F, A flat, B flat, C, D. Like the higher you go, the smaller the
intervals becomes. Yeah, that's crazy. That's amazing. Now, when you're 13 years old, like that has got to be a hard instrument, just like, you know, physically, because you can't have the arm length to hit some of those notes, I'm sure, right?
I was pretty tall for my age. I was pretty tall. I was like one of the tall kids for my grade. But
and did you do like marching band or was it jazz band?
Yeah, it was jazz band.
And what kind of stuff were you playing? Do you remember?
Yeah, just the traditional, just like the basics. Like we learned the blues scale, we learned the rhythm changes, and it was mostly about repertory. Mostly like the repertoire, like the classic repertoire that they would teach us.
And did you fall in love with any trombonists at that young of an age, or were you still kind of discovering jazz and kind of, you know, smitten with all of it?
Well, I really liked James Brown. We're gonna have a funky good time.
High five, because Fred West is one of my favorites.
Yeah, Fred West. Yeah.
He is my absolute favorite trombonist.
Yeah, that was one of the first songs I learned on trombone. Although I had to do it an octave lower, because at the time I had braces.
Wow.
I had braces on my teeth and couldn't play very.
You're like, I gotta play lower. I can't do this. You know, I heard a friend of mine, a horn player, told me he read Fred Wesley's book. And James Brown would say, yeah, this is what I want it to be arranged like. And then Fred Wesley would just do it the way he wanted to do it.
Oh, damn.
And that's how the arrangements are. So, like, Fred Wesley really just kind of created these horn arrangements that James Brown didn't even know were being created in the same, you know, in that way. Like, and James Brown was just assuming it was what he was saying, but it totally was not, you know, because the language was not the same, because James Brown wasn't hearing horn arrangements. It's a different language, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So, like, Fred West was, like, just, like, nodding to him, and he's like, I'm just going to make this horn arrangement the way I know how to make it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maceo Parker, too. He's one of my favorite players as well. Those two just, like, they just kill it, you know? Just ridiculous. So, you are going through middle school. You go through high school. I assume you're in high school jazz band as well?
Yeah, high school.
And then you decided, I want to do this for a career. When was that moment?
It was mostly about the writing part of being a jazz musician, that was turning point, because I started, you know, writing songs for my jazz combo back in high school. I was writing, I was arranging, and I really wanted to write, but I didn't want to lose sight of, you know, being a performer. I didn't want to be, as one of my old teachers quotes, a slave to the pen.
Well, they're all different muscles, you know what I mean? That's what I always find. It's like, there's a writing muscle, there's a performing muscle, and it's like, if they're not activated, they can kind of get weaker. So it's like, you kind of have to keep all of them just moving in a direction that's forward progress always. It's kind of like the monkey on my back. I always think, like, am I writing enough? Am I playing enough? Am I performing enough? Those are always the three things, you know?
Yeah.
When did you start recording? Did you record in high school at all?
In college, yeah. But then again, I mean, that was like just a part of the school. That was like,
And you went to Cal Arts, right?
Cal State.
Northridge. Cal State, that's right. Cal State Northridge, that's right.
Yeah, and the director of the A band at the time, Matt Harris. I was in the A band at the time, and he had this segment where he just did this project where the A band just recorded a bunch of tunes at a recording studio. I'm blanking on the name, but yeah, he let students record their originals.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. That's pretty rad. Like, yeah, having your students, like, you know, do their thing.
And when you write an original for, like, an instrumental, like, do you start with the head? Do you start with the kind of chords? How does it work for you? What's your process?
It's different for every tune. I don't mean that in, like, a pretentious, no, that's like, all right, snooty way. But, I guess on my album, per se, a lot of the tunes, they started off, like, one started off with just a melody, and I just built on it. And then another started off with a melody and orchestration, and it built off on the orchestration. And then another one started off on just the form. And the form, I think, is kind of an unsung, understated part of composition. Because, like, I don't mean to sound, like, cheesy, but when you write a song, it's basically like a story, and a story has a form. And one of the teachers I had at a New England conservatory, John Hollenbeck, he was very big about having a song be about a form. Because no one ever looks at the form.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So one of the pieces is very form-based. It's like, you got this, and it's more just...
And are you thinking like A section, B section? Is that how you're thinking about it? Or is it like... Because it's not like verse and chorus like a songwriter. Or is it?
Some yes, some no. Like one of the pieces that I brought in, that I brought into my teacher, John Hollenbeck. It was more like, okay, where's the form in this? It doesn't have to be like, you know, verse chorus, you know, bridge verse chorus, you know, all that jazz. But
pun intended.
It can be, yeah. If it can be. It can be if you want it to be, but it was more like, okay, where's this going and what's the shape of it? He was more about, like, you know, looking at the forest versus looking at the leaves.
Right. I love that. And also, like, you're looking at where the melody's going and building throughout the song. I think that's awesome. I'm always amazed with horn players how they can notate, because they can notate so fast. Like, their ears are always, like, even just you singing all the intervals, it's just like, crazy that you just hear music and you see it in the same way on that same parallel. So it's like, you know, sometimes when I play with horn players, like, we'll be in the middle of a song and you'll hear somebody sing something. One of the horn players will sing a part or, like, say a quick note, and then all the horn players are in. I'm like, dude, that is crazy. Like, that just only happens in a horn section.
Yeah.
Tell me how, like, you know, when you're making big band arrangements, are there certain parts of the horns that you want to feature more than others? Obviously, you're a trombonist, but are you diplomatic in how you write your parts? Or?
I do try to be. In fact, I was very vigilant in one of a recent piece that I arranged by. It was a piece by Wayne Shorter, Night Dreamer, and I arranged the piece, and I made sure, like, each section kind of got their own, like, solely. During the solo break, and I really wanted the piece to be about the band, not just about, like, one particular instrument. Even though that particular track, it featured soprano sax, just because, you know, it's a Wayne Shorter tune.
Yeah, totally.
Like, how can you not feature a sax on a Wayne Shorter tune? And but that kind of goes. With the rest of the EP that I released, is that I wanted to feature the band. I wanted to be about the band, about the different sections, rather than just about, oh, like, the composer. Like, hey, it's about the band. It's not about me, it's about them.
That's, you know, you're a rarity in that. I love that about you. Also, one thing I love about your background, you studied music on the West Coast. And then you flipped it and went to the East Coast for your master's. What was that transition like? And did you feel like there was a different kind of vibe, East Coast to West Coast musicians?
Well, East Coast was really cold. East Coast was very... Boston is the coldest place I've ever... Well, temperature-wise, climate-wise.
Yeah.
You got to see, like... Boston, it's not the entertainment capital of the world. It's not like Los Angeles, where you got Hollywood, you've got Universal Studios,
right.
You've got NBC, CBS, you've got all these entities here. Boston isn't really like that. And but at the same time, I think it's a wonderful place to learn. And it's a brilliant place to go to school. And because... Okay, there's a lot of schools around there.
You have Berkeley, right?
Yeah, you got, yeah.
New England Conservatory.
Oh, yeah, you have New England Conservatory at Boston, Berkeley, Boston Conservatory.
And are you kind of like mishmashing with all these like musicians from all these schools, or is it kind of like you're playing with most of the people in your program?
Oh, people from all around. So, some cats from Northeastern, even.
Wow.
Because Northeastern is right by New England Conservatory.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. So then you came back to LA and you were like, I want to make a record, right?
Well, I had wanted to make a record back when I was in Boston, but it didn't get released until I was in LA.
Why is that?
Well, you know, I recorded it when I was in Boston, and I had the cats there. I had some of my best friends were there, and they had the chops. And they also knew the music. They knew the songs. They knew the tunes. And so I figured it was easier to work with people who already knew the tunes. And so we recorded the album. Everything was hunky-dory. And then I came back to Los Angeles, and, you know, any cross-continental move is tough.
That's the thing I was just about to say. It's not just tough. It is a monumental change in all aspects, because you're preparing for a different season. Yep. Like season change, or there are no seasons in LA, whereas there are huge changes in seasons in Massachusetts.
Yep.
You know, then it's also like the distance too. It's like you have to. You travel light, you know what I mean? It's like you really just probably have your horn and your essentials. And because when you make a move like that, you're not bringing your IKEA dresser, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're getting rid of all that stuff. Exactly. Yeah,
you have to sell like half your possessions so that you can just move move cross continentally. And like the move itself, it was pretty crazy. And, you know, just trying to get readjusted was pretty insane, but I mean, eventually, you know, it makes sense. Like any cross continental move, you have to make the adjustment. Take a while to get your feet on the ground.
Yeah,
get back on your feet.
Well, let's play a track. What do you want to play first?
Oh, I guess how about Night Dreamer?
Night Dreamer. That was the one I was looking at too. All right. So tell us a little backstory about this.
Well, I mean, because, you know, it's an arrangement. Lots of people know the tune, and I personally love the Wayne Shorter tune "Night Dreamer." I love the album, and that's what kind of inspired me to make the to make an arrangement of the tune "Night Dreamer."
Awesome! This is Mario Austin, "Night Dreamer." Thank you. Oh, yeah. Audience loved it. You know what? I love it so much because nobody's doing big band stuff, and that's like some of the biggest foundations of music for the 20s, the 30s, the 40s. You know, it's like that's what it was. You know, it's like I hate that that is almost like a dying breed now because it's such exquisite, sophisticated music, musicianship, and arrangements. Your arrangements were amazing. What a great arrangement. So I was just talking to you, you know, off the air. So you recorded this whole thing live except for some overdubs with the vibes. Anything else overdubbed?
A voice. Yeah, because, like, I was singing and I was playing trombone. And at the time, like, I was at the time that we were recording the big band, I was conducting. And I've always found it, like, you know, very, very difficult to conduct and sing at the same time. And conduct and sing and play trombone at the same time. And I didn't want to compromise, you know.
Amazing. Like, and had you conducted a big band before?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've had to do that before. I'm not an expert, like, you know, I'm not Gustav Dudamel.
But you can get it done. You can get it done. I've had to conduct voices, and it's not easy. Like, you really gain respect real quick for a conductor just because, like, it's that interpretation of the music. It's mm-hmm. the getting the nuances and the dynamics, all those things. But you were able to do this, and you had, what, maybe 20 musicians playing.
But funny, well, I mean, like, the last track probably had, like, the most people playing.
And, like, when you're thinking of arrangement, are you thinking, do you kind of start off thinking, okay, I want this to be this huge, lush arrangement with 20 instruments, or do you start small and just build and it becomes bigger?
Like, if I have, like, the germ of a sea, like, if I have the germ of a song?
Yeah.
Some songs, yes, they work, they can work, you know, in a bigger setting. Some songs, maybe not. Some songs are a lot more intimate and, you know, just need to be a little bit, like, smaller. But some songs, yes, that, like, they can. They definitely have the potential to, you know, be this big old thing.
Well, it's just amazing. I mean, I hear a lot of Glenn Miller, like what I was saying, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, some of these old schoolers that were doing these killer big band arrangements in what you're doing. Just your chords, so lush, so beautiful. Are there any, like, do you have, like, favorite chords that you hit with horns or anything like that?
Specifically favorite chords?
Yeah. Sometimes people do. Like, they'll hit certain like, second to last chords, or, you know what I mean? Like, they'll do crazy 9s, 11s, 13s.
Well, yeah, 9s, 11s, 13s, you can't go wrong with that. If you're ending the song on a major chord, it's like 9, 11, 13. It's you're like, right.
Yeah.
It's like you're in church, and it's like the benediction, like, in the middle of the tune, what I like to do is a lot of sus chords. And you might have heard, like, in that past track, in that past track, there were a lot of, like F7, F13 sus, and then G-flat 13 sus. You just take one sus chord and then just move it up a half step, and it's just like, boom.
Killer. And let me ask you this too, like, when you're writing these horn arrangements, are you also writing the bass lines too, or did you give the bass player a little bit of freedom? Because that they can really just change chords with some of the lines that they're playing. Or did you keep it like you wrote the bass part too and said, you need to play this?
A little bit simultaneously, because, you know, like, coming from a trombone player, like, a lot of trombone charts, like, a lot of trombone parts are kind of built into the bass line. Like, if you look at a lot of trombone scores, the bass trombone part, for example, often doubles with the bass, the upright bass part, or like, you know, the left hand of the piano, and so a lot of what I write on horn can it's like influenced by the bass.
love it. Let's play something else. What do you want to play next?
Oh. how much time do we have?
We're going to do at least two more songs.
Oh, okay. Well, there was one tune that I was commissioned to do track number 3. It's called Mirror Shift.
You know what? We're on the same wavelength because I was just looking at that. All right, Mirror Shift. And this got featured. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it was a commission, actually, by the New York Youth Symphony. I had applied for a competition 1 year to have a piece played by them, and I was one of the I was one of the winners per se, and they're like, okay, well, we're commissioning you to write a piece for a big band, and it fits within this certain instrumentation, this length in time, and work your magic. they pretty much just left me to my own devices. Of course.
Did you make it easier or harder for the youth to play it?
That's not really for me to say because the age group that was playing it was high school and college age, and so yeah, they were perfectly capable of playing what I was writing down on paper. I had no doubts whatsoever. It was mostly what came at the end, which is when the horn players took off their horns, put their horns down, and did something unexpected. It was the unexpected factor at the end, which is kind of which is what I wanted to coach them on. That was when I was like, okay, should I present this to a high school band?
That's awesome. Well, let's hear this. Mariel Austin, Mirror Shift. Here it comes. so beautiful. Seriously. You know, the funny thing is I heard a lot of Isaac Hayes. Like, it was like a slower Isaac Hayes Shaft arrangement in some parts.
Isaac Hayes?
Oh man, he's like one of my favorites.
I've never gotten that before.
It was, you know, there were some arrangements in some parts of it where it was like, oh yeah, totally hear this, like the Shaft, you know, the theme song for Shaft.
Oh dang!
But it was at like a slower tempo. It wasn't as like crazy upbeat. It was like more of a mellow vibe. I loved it. It sounded great. It sounded really great. And I love the core arrangement that you have at the end. How many singers did you have for that?
Oh, I just had the horn players just put down their horns and start singing.
What? So, seriously?
Yeah, it was just the horn players and people in the rhythm section, whoever was comfortable in the rhythm section to sing. Like, I told the rhythm section, like, hey, I know you guys are, like, you know, playing your instruments. If you're okay with singing and playing your instruments, that's cool. But if not, that's totally fine. You can just lay it on the group. You don't have to sing. Like, that's totally fine. Like, so... Yeah, but the horn players, like, they all just put down the horns and sang.
Did you have them do it in parts live, or did you have them do all one part and then track another part, track another harmony?
That was another overdub, come to think about it. Like, we recorded the song as is, and, later, the horn players, they came in, and the horn players and whatever rhythm instrumentalists were comfortable doing it, that they came in. And we divvied up parts, like, okay, who's comfortable singing alto? Who's comfortable singing tenor? Who's on bass? Who's on baritone? You know, and we just kind of like
The choir like in the studio. That's crazy. Yeah. That's amazing.
I mean, like, we divvied up parts like in rehearsals. Like, I was like, okay, who's comfortable singing alto? You know, who's comfortable with which range? And it was mostly guys, and there was like one other girl in the ensemble, so like she was alto, obviously. And
that's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. So let me ask you this: when you're writing and you're in the studio, is there a difference between what you're writing and what comes of your composition in the studio? Like, how does it evolve, or does it evolve, or is it strict to the notes on the page?
Like, when I was recording this?
Yeah, so, like, let's say you wrote this song, right? And I imagine you had everything kind of already worked out.
Yeah.
Is everybody playing to the page? Yeah. Or is there, like, interpretation? Are there little changes? How do the songs evolve once they're in the studio?
Oh, yes, it's very much on the page. However, funny you should mention it, in the last track, in the title track of the EP, there's this one section where it's kind of like this improv thing, where it's kind of like classical improv, where the instructions are there, but, like, you know, you don't have to be a jazz musician to be able to read the what's on there. Like any person can like, see there's like a set of notes given, like a set of tone rows given, and the person kind of improvises off.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
So,
well, I mean, I come from classical music, so it's like, that's not always done like that. So it's amazing. I'm always fascinated with jazz musicians because I feel like they're the most accomplished musicians of all musicians, because they can kind of, their technique is there, their playing is there, they can improvise, they can arrange. It's like kind of amazing. What do you want to play next? Let's play something else.
If we got time, maybe the title track.
Which is Runner in the Rain?
Yeah.
All right, here it is. Mariel Austin, Runner in the Rain.
Running through the grass. grass and the trees and the thawed ground and every city east of the sun.
Yeah, that was beautiful. We couldn't play the whole arrangement because we're running out of time. But real quick, where can people find you if they want you to do an arrangement for them or to do horn parts, performance? Where can people find you? Give us all your links and and handles and all that stuff.
Well, you can find me on my website, www.marielleaustin.com.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
www.marielleaustin. That's marielleaustin.com.
Awesome. And people can find you on social media and all that stuff as well?
Oh, yeah, that's true. And there's also, I also have a SoundCloud page. You just search Marielle Austin, Runner in the Rain.
Runner in the rain. I love your music. I love your vibe. You're a tremendous composer, singer, and player. Just incredible. I love it. You're going to have to come back in about 9-10 months and tell us what's new with you. This is awesome. Well, on behalf of Ronan and myself and Eddie, we'll see you guys next week.